Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Fleming Schutrump on building a portfolio to escape the 9-to-5. Dan Breslin here, your REI Diamonds Show host. Today's episode on building a portfolio to escape the 9-to-5 comes from Fleming's experience in the Denver, Colorado market. You probably don't know this, but at the beginning of this year, I attempted to open Diamond Equity Investments, my real estate investment company, in the Denver and Boulder, Colorado area. I failed miserably and left without ever closing a single deal. Thank God I didn't buy any deals that I bought for the wrong price and get stuck in that, but the market was way too competitive for me to stick around and bleed anymore. Fleming lives there, so he invests there for that reason. He has some remarkable experience in timing the market perfectly. Some of his properties have doubled and even tripled in value in less than 10 years. Talk about buying right, huh? Let's get started. All right, welcome to the show, Fleming.
Thank you, Dan. It's a pleasure to be here.
So where are you currently recording this episode from?
I'm in sunny Denver, Colorado.
So we got sunny Denver, Colorado. I am staring out at Lake Michigan here at my condo in Chicago. And you're in Denver, Colorado with clear skies, I'm guessing. What's the weather like out there?
It's about high 80s, few clouds. It's a gorgeous day. So blessed to be here.
Beautiful. So Fleming, for listeners that may not know who you are, you want to give a little bit of a background, maybe what you did before you got in real estate or what led you into real estate, and then, you know, kind of the progress of your business and what it looks like today?
Yeah, I'd love to. I actually dropped out of high school. I finished after 11th grade. I took the GED, ended up actually getting the highest grade on the GED exam in the state of Colorado, and went to college early. And I think that came out of being rebellious. And I really feel that to be successful in life, we have to be rebellious and contrarian and not do what the herd does. And I think one of the pivotal stories that kind of got me started in real estate is I was motorcycling around the USA when I was 18. I had a little 650 Yamaha and I rode 10,000 miles in about a month. But I was,
nice.
I would just camp along the side of the road, and I was in the South, and I think it was Mississippi, but beautiful country road, and it was starting to get dark, beautiful sunset. So I found along the side of the road, there was some woods, and there was basically this abandoned house. Essentially, all that was left of it was the perimeter stone foundation and the stone fireplace. And so I parked my bike and set up the tent, and I was eating SpaghettiOs out of a can. And all of a sudden, I heard this loud engine throb, and it was starting to get dark, so the guy had like all his lights on. I couldn't see who it was, but there's this voice out of the bright light, pack up and get out of here within 3 minutes or I'll shoot you. And I'm like, okay, sir. Yes, sir. And just started like packing up my tent real quick, bungee cording it to my bike and getting the hell out of there. But it's one of those pivotal lessons that if you own property, you get to tell others what to do. And if you don't, other people basically get to tell you what to do. And later I got my MBA, and I was fresh out of MBA school, had a job as a management consultant at a big IT management consulting firm. And my team lead, whenever she went out of town or was on client site, had her assistant team lead be what used to be the receptionist, who had a high school degree, didn't have a master's degree like me. And she was always the assistant team lead. And after that happened 3 or 4 times, I'm like, huh, there isn't a plan for helping the MBA guy actually get real management experience. And I decided I'm going to manage something. And so that got me really motivated to buy my first rental property. So I went out, found a condo, learned a bit about dealing with realtors, not all of whom are as wonderful as the industry wants you to believe they are, and bought a condo, rented out successfully, and that started me on my journey as a landlord. And over working as a management consultant full-time for about 15 years, and that's like a 50-hour-a-week job with lots of travel, I ended up acquiring 35 properties and keeping those as long-term rentals. So I really believe in the power of buy and hold. And also, having worked in IT, 80% of IT projects fail, where essentially the code that is written never gets put into production. And so when I hang a door or I tile a backsplash, that's real, that's physical, that's out there. And that it was such a contrast to IT projects, which don't usually do that.
Interesting. So do you still do the IT consulting, anything else, you know, corporate America with the MBA, or is it strictly real estate now?
No, I'm actually extremely fortunate to have gotten laid off in 2014. And the story there too, I had transitioned into sales, and I was working for a small IT consulting firm. 10 really smart people founded it in 2001. And in 2014, I realized their collective net worth was less than mine as a landlord. And so I started being a lot more assertive about, hey guys, if you want to grow the business, you got to take risks. And especially the CFO, and accountants tend to be risk averse, but he didn't agree. And so I got back from Peru, actually, my first day back from vacation, and they're like, meeting in the CEO's office. And I'm like, huh, that sounds funny. And I go in there and they're like, Fleming, we're going to have to lay you off. I'm like, okay. And then I'm like, tell me why. And they're like, we can't tell you. You know, you could sue us. And I'm like, I'm not going to sue you. Tell me why. And they're like, no, we're not going to tell you. I'm like, come on, tell me. And finally, the CFO is like, you remind me of my ex-wife. We talk, but we don't communicate.
But congratulations on getting laid off, Fleming.
Thank you. And I've never gone back. And I'm thrilled that real estate is such a powerful investment vehicle that I now have freedom that most people can't. And because of that, actually launching my first book next month, which is Buy Your First Investment Property Fast, because everybody can do this. You know, a lot of people have jobs with brass handcuffs, and there's a way out. And real estate is a wonderful vehicle to getting out of that economic captivity.
So I didn't have the good job. A fun fact about me that I know my audience, nobody probably knows about me. I had intended on dropping out of high school. So I went and got my GED, and then circumstances led to me just finishing and getting the diploma anyway. So I have my GED and I have my high school diploma, which was kind of unique.
Cool.
But yeah, but I was like car sales, you know, bouncing around to different jobs in my early 20s. And then by the time I was 26 and got into real estate, like there was no, like my bridges were burned. The boats were burned, you know, where the Vikings would come to conquer an island and they would get to the island or, you know, the mainland, burn the boats. So they had to win the battle and basically get success and get their mission accomplished because there was no turning back. And my boats were burned. There was no other job. There was no, you know, brass handcuffs where I had something that was providing my income. And I think a lot of people, just like you describe, are going to be, it almost could be like a detriment to have a decent paying 9-to-5 job because you may not have the same tenacity and hunger to build a 35 rental property portfolio. Can we talk about a little bit of the progression there? So you're in Denver. I'm going to go out on a limb. I know that the Denver market is hot. I made an attempt early this year to get into that market myself, and it just didn't work out. I didn't have the right people on the ground. I didn't have any teams in place, and I didn't have the stick-to-itness or the time, because I'm in 5 other markets around the country, to really dig down and make it start. But my brief experience there, Fleming, was that that market has been hot, if not super heated, over the past couple years, and a great place to have owned property, you know, over the long term. So I'm gonna guess that you probably own locally in Colorado, and I'm gonna ask you to kind of maybe just talk about the progression, a couple of the early properties, when it started to really feel like you got some traction, and then maybe if you hit a stride where you were acquiring and adding properties, you know, rapidly to get to this number, or maybe you did them all slow, just kind of give people an idea of how you built that.
No, you guessed exactly right. So I bought that first condo that I told you about, and then after that I got ambitious and I bought a sixplex. And that one I really bit my teeth out on. I had at one point 3 of the 6 tenants not paying rent. And essentially, one of the tenants was kind of a ringleader. There was some local nonprofit that was actually giving advice on how to screw your landlord. I actually evicted him, and then the sheriff was there to evict him, and I had just changed the lock, and he came running up, and he had just filed bankruptcy, and the sheriff's like, change the lock back. And
oh, wow.
So I had to do that. And then bankruptcy is interesting. So if you have a tenant who files bankruptcy, because of the potential that the tenant has assets that other creditors can get, you as the landlord get to be the free storage facility. And so the bankruptcy court automatically stays or basically prevents any eviction. And then it took 6 months to get that bankruptcy overturned. And then I had to evict him again. And the whole process cost actually about $7,000. So that was an expensive venture. But ultimately, even during months when I was really like biting my nails and subsidizing the mortgage out of my own paycheck, the property ended up going up about $5,000-$6,000 a month. I sold it a year and a couple months later for a $100,000 profit. And that's the power of real estate, especially in a rising market. And after that, I bought some condos, but I stayed away out of the multifamily just because of having that kind of traumatic experience. But in 2007, I met a big real estate investor in Boulder, Colorado, and he's my idol and my mentor, and his name is Bob. And he really showed me that instead of my prior vision, which is that I own a property and that once the mortgage is paid off, I have cash flows, that I should have cash flows from day one. And just when he opened my eyes to that, the meltdown happened in late 2007, early 2008. And I actually bought probably 25 properties between 2007 and 2014.
So that's when you hit your stride. Was perfect timing. You had some experiences, ups and downs, and then in the best buying cycle that we've had in certainly my life is when you went on your rapid buying spree, right?
Yes, and it's fascinating because I think around 2003, I found a book in the thrift store, and it was published in 1963, and it was called something like How to Profit from the Coming Economic Meltdown. And I read it, and it actually like quoted Greenspan, who was a young buck at the Fed at the time. And they said, Greenspan is wrong, and his policies will cause a meltdown. And from 2003 to 2007 was a long time, but certainly from 1963 to 2007 is a really long time. So those policies ended up being right. What I had done, that's my kind of fortunateness, is that I got a bunch of lines of credit while it was still possible, and I was able to use those once the meltdown happened to pick up as much real estate as I could.
All right. So you're using these lines of credit. Were you just buying them, packaging them in, you know, 3-5, doing refinances to pay the line of credit off? What did the financing structure look like for you?
I found a couple local banks because I quickly got beyond the 10 mortgage maximum that the national lenders like Wells Fargo or Bank of America will work with. And the local banks, as long as I put 35% down, were willing to continue financing my acquisitions. And so that was basically my financing structure, is try and find the 35% and then mortgage the rest. And that got hard. It got hard in the sense that I ran out of money and my job certainly wasn't enough to put down 35% on a $100,000 property. But once I had enough rentals too, I noticed that my accumulated cash flow, that every 3 months I could buy another one because I was cash flowing that much.
What is your requirement? Let's dig into like one deal, just some random deal in the 2007 to 14 era. What was the cash flow requirement? What was the purchase price? You know, what is the rental that you were collecting when you bought the property? Just to give our audience an idea of kind of what your parameters were. And maybe you could also talk about what they were before when you were trying to pay down the mortgage and then get to cash flow and how that might have shifted and what your requirements would be if you bought something, you know, today, 3 years ago, whatever it was.
Absolutely. Yes. So one of the properties I bought in early 2008 was actually from a hard money lender. And this illustrates how brutal that meltdown actually was. A investor had bought a property for $80,000 thinking that they could fix it up and sell it for a profit. And then they ended up failing on that and the hard money lender took it back and sold it to me for $50,000. And that was the closest that I've ever gotten to a no money down transaction because I put like $3,500 down and the rest got financed. It was terrible interest rate, like 11%. So it was kind of hard money, but I basically didn't have to cough up much cash. I spent, let's say, $15,000 rehabbing it. And then for a 3-bedroom house in a pretty marginal neighborhood, I was getting $695 a month in rent. So from a multiple perspective, I look at it, if I pay $50,000 and $15,000 in rehab, so $65,000 and I'm getting $650,000, that works for me. If I pay $75,000 and I only get $75,000, I only get $650 in rent. That's a bad deal in my eyes.
Okay. What is that property worth today now that the market has changed in Denver area?
So the market has gone up tremendously, and most of that run-up has been in the last 3 years or so. But my ex-wife now owns that particular property, but it's worth about $225,000. So that's a phenomenal return since 2007.
Okay. So you got in at the right time, and it's worth what it's worth now. Are you having trouble finding deals in your market currently, or are you still able to find opportunities that fit these parameters you're looking for?
I'm having some serious trouble. So I think what you experience trying to enter the Denver market is what I see every day as a investor here. I got a couple really great deals at the beginning of this year, but it's because I've been working with a seller for the past 8 years, and somehow his mortgage company forgave the loans, and I was then able to purchase the properties. That's pretty unlikely to happen on a regular basis, though.
Yeah, true enough. So what's your plan at this point, right? You rode the market up. Are you comfortable just kind of sitting tight, or would you still be in buy mode, or are you kind of sitting on the fence waiting for another opportunity or maybe looking at other markets?
So I was listening to a bunch of Robert Kiyosaki CDs, and he had some interesting testimonials from students about how great of a teacher Robert Kiyosaki was. But one of the students mentioned that they had invested out of state in the South, and it had really bad luck finding a good property management company, and that buying local really was the thing. And my mentor, Bob, is all about local. Like, if you can't drive to it, it's more likely you're going to get ripped off. And I certainly had an experience, actually a few experiences. I've gone through about 5 property management companies, and I feel all of them at some level ripped me off. One really badly for the guy walked away with $14,000 in tenant security deposits. And so I'm a strong believer in being local. I feel like that has worked really well for me.
Do you self-manage, Fleming?
I do. And it's amazing to me. It's just because when you have property managers, they're like, oh, this is such hard work and you're not paying me enough and this and that. And now that I self-manage, I'm like, what? What work? Like, I do a really nice, I do a great remodel before people move in. And when people are there, things don't break.
Yeah, I bought like 15 units in the last 12 months or so. That's my first, re-entry back into the real estate thing. I'm just going to talk about why I did that, because I think it's important for some people to know. I got into real estate, had no other alternative in my life for making money at the time. And I know a lot of people do find themselves laid off, maybe like happened to you, Fleming, and then they're now looking for a career change and they have to figure out something in real estate to make money. And there's a lot of people who have become very successful with real estate as their main source of income, whether that's flipping houses, whether that is wholesaling houses, whether that is building up a rental portfolio over time and properly managing, just like you're doing right now and have done over the past
Absolutely.
Couple of years. But I think it's really important if you don't have, I think you have to start off and look at life and say, do I have a money machine in place already? And what I mean by a money machine is some main source of income, whether that's the six-figure job or, the high-paying job or the business that's producing money, whether that's a real estate business, flipping houses, a real estate business, wholesaling properties, whether that is a pizza shop or some other business that you happen to be in and make money. There has to be some, original cash generating machine. And I watched a lot of people who didn't really have a money machine in place in 2005, 6, 7. It was strictly buying properties, refinancing, taking extra cash out, and they're buying these properties after the mortgage payment. Maybe they have $100 or $200, additional monthly cash flow, but that's not enough to sustain a huge hit like you had to take on that sixplex deal, Fleming, where you're like
it's
funding
not.
The $7,000 in legal fees and you're funding the mortgage payment. And like, had you not had some other source of income, you would have been high and dry. And that's what so many people had got themselves into in 2006, 7, 8, and 9. That was what we saw was a lot of that taking place. So before I got into rentals, I had to master and build out my, wholesaling and house flipping business and made sure that I had enough cash coming in. Because of those 15 properties, I think I have like 4 or 5 evictions going on. Like as we speak, I had to put more money in repairs into some of the units than I was anticipating. you know, the list goes on and on and on of little issues that I had pop up in
Can
the first
I comment
year
on that?
Of ownership. Absolutely.
I think the worst thing is to buy a property with tenants in it, because inevitably they're terrible tenants. That's why the seller is selling, is because of those tenants. And so I think maybe some of your evictions are just related to that.
They are. And I think I've evicted of the, you know, 9 properties I've bought occupied, I probably had to evict 7.
Yeah.
Or I'm in the process of it now. For me, I bought
a package.
You have
to price it in. It's almost like you have to price that in, because that's what makes people a motivated seller. And for you, you're going to still not get rent for a couple months once you own it.
Exactly. And I did. I built it into the price. I bought 6 at one time, and, you know, 3 of those tenants are a hassle. That's fine. I'm okay with it. I bought those properties specifically because they fit into my investment philosophy surrounding properties, which is to buy in areas, micro markets, in each of the markets that I'm located. Right now, I'm buying in Atlanta, Chicago, and Philadelphia. In areas that I believe are going to gentrify over the course of time, they might have a ton of investment. They might be in the path of progress. It's not, I mean, you know, our general real estate market is going up overall, just partially as a result of the demographic trend as the millennials are coming into the age of home buying years. But in these markets like South Philadelphia, the Atlanta Beltline, these are areas where we believe property prices could and have doubled in the last, you know, 5 to 7 years as the wave of progress goes through the older inventory. It's getting renovated, built up, new construction, things of that nature. So that's kind of my goal in selecting properties that I want to own. They have the cash flow now up front, but it's more for me like a place to save my cash that I'm making for my other businesses in an area I believe that will continue to increase. And then also I have that rental income coming in as well to kind of sweeten the pot.
I really believe in that. I think holding property long-term is a great way to get wealth. Even when you're 80, like, you're going to get checks in the mail, and the maintenance is not that much. If you do a thorough kind of turnover maintenance thing when you have tenants move out, you don't have much while you have tenants in there when repairs would be more urgent. And I met your buddy Austin at Tony Robbins Business Mastery in Vegas. And from what I hear, you have a great machine at just making real estate work. So I'm extremely impressed how you built that up coming from selling used cars and stuff like that.
Thanks. It's been a real blessing, a real godsend, and a real pleasure to meet people like Austin, who's been on the show. I'll make sure I link to his recent episode. He will be on the show again. I met Austin through one of our real estate networking events. So we'll host these events partially to invite, you know, the audience of our podcast here out to actually meet us in person when we're in Philadelphia, Atlanta, and the Chicago market. So Austin walked in and we happened to meet, you know, at the networking event, and he was hustling. He was out there doing, you know, doing all the work, trying to find his way on his own. And then when we finally did link up after he had moved to Atlanta, he really hit the ground running. It was like his place where he was at, his experience, and then it meshed with our system. And then we entered the Atlanta market. And of course, it's a very hot market. It's a great market to do what we do, whether that's house flipping, whether that is rental property, or whether that's wholesaling like a lot of our businesses. Atlanta's great with population growth there and just a pro-business environment. So it's been really cool watching Austin and a lot of the other people that are on my team grow in the business and make a lot of deals, point blank, make a lot of money.
Yeah, I met him when we were exchanging our goals for the year, and I'm extremely impressed. He has a sight set really high, and he has that conviction he's going to do it. It made me very intrigued to meet you and learn more about you, because clearly what you teach works.
Last year when Austin and I guess in January, checked over his goals, I thought, man, he's kind of a little ambitious, I think. And then we hit those goals, and we did double the goal. I like to do them on a monthly basis. We doubled the monthly goal that he had set out the 1 month. That was pretty cool to see that taking place. So let me ask you this, Fleming, back to the Denver market. Did you intentionally buy these properties and think that they were going to increase in value the way that I, you know, have placed my bets methodically in Chicago, Atlanta, and Philadelphia in advance of gentrification? Or was that like an accidental thing? Or did you actually think that through and say, yeah, this is why I'm buying in these areas for specific reasons?
That's a wonderful question. And the real answer is no. People told me I'm crazy, that real estate is messed and it's never going to get better. And I'm like, I don't care. I like fixing these properties up. And if I make a little pocket money, that's all I need. And so now in retrospect, I look really smart. But that wasn't my goal. And if you remember how despondent people were in 2008, I had my boss, basically, he had $1 million in retirement funds and it shrank to like 300K. And he's like, well, I might have to move in with my parents. He was terrified. The work dried up. And this was a senior VP who's talking about moving in with his parents. So it was just a horrible time when confidence was completely shaken, in not just real estate, but in everything that's part of the economy. And I feel I just got lucky because I like fixing up houses. And it's interesting because I live down the road from Boulder, Colorado, where houses are extremely high priced and probably double what they cost in Denver. And I can't do my business in Boulder. I can't deal with a 3% cap rate or buy a house for $1 million that I get $1,700 a month on. But in Denver, it's worked out great. And I didn't have much money, so I bought the $50,000 houses, and those are the ones that have actually appreciated the most. If you buy something above 400 grand, the appreciation rate is much lower.
So it was almost just accidental. It just happened to be the path that you chose, and then the tailwind of the market really helped you out.
Yeah, and it's kind of funny. I met a guy who restores cars, and he bought, because he was short on money, he bought a Ford Pinto and made it a really nice, beautifully restored Pinto, but it's still a Pinto. And, you know, he put $5,000 into it and it's worth $6,000 now. And for the same amount of labor, I remodeled three properties that now gave me, pick a number, $200,000 in sweat equity.
I'd rather be in your shoes than in the driver's seat of the Pinto.
Don't get rear-ended.
Not a chance. So over the last year or two, Fleming, have you implemented any single idea, system, or strategy and experienced maybe like exponential growth or exponential freedom or just, you know, outstanding results from that system, strategy, or idea?
That's a great question. The one thing I've never tried before until last year is doing a mailing and trying to get off-market properties. And that's pretty much the only way to try and get good value purchases in Denver nowadays. I mailed 2,500 postcards. And the crazy thing is normally I'm told to expect about a 1% response rate, which would be about 25 calls. I actually only got 3. Luckily, one of those was actually a motivated seller out of California who had, when I toured the property, they had carpeted the whole unit, including the kitchen and the bathroom. So you can imagine how nasty that carpet is around the stove and especially around the toilet. But yeah, I got a decent price and I did a flip. And I feel that in this market, it's hard to get a good rental, a good keeper. And so I'm looking more at flips now. But I think I'm still somewhat shell-shocked. I see appreciation that's just out of the stratosphere, that properties that were 400,000 at the beginning of the year are now 465 or something. And it's really hard to see that being sustainable, although there's no signs of it letting off either.
For the show notes, I'm going to link to a recent monthly market update that we do with Paul Sloat. And we do have, he's an economist and he comes on, and single family housing, there just seems to be, according to the numbers, not enough units being built since 2009. We had an overbuilding of units prior to that era, you know, in 2004, 5, 6, 7, and then 8, 9, everything stopped. And now we've been running at about a 300,000 unit deficit in the United States. So while we may see some markets that become oversaturated and overbuilt and level off before others, you know, the overall economics of the market kind of point towards sustaining, if not that continued growth. Like, I don't think we can have 465 go to 535, go to 615, but, you know, even if it does level off and it doesn't crater like it did in 2007, I think that most of the homeowners and investors will be like happy with that. And that's kind of what the numbers point to, is a little bit of like stability or consistency, consistent demand, consistent underwriting of the mortgages, and a lot of the things that took place in 2006 and 7 are not really, the underlying fundamentals just aren't there for that giant cratering in the single family space as much. I could be completely wrong in that, but I'll include that. You brought up an interesting point. 2,500 postcards. I think I did 15,000. I do letters. You know, 25 out of 2,500 probably will be expected with postcards. I imagine they're getting many pieces of mail in the Colorado market because we got dismal results too. That was our foray, our failed entry into Colorado was the same experience that you had with the postcard campaign.
Okay.
I'm not the only one.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's interesting that that's the case. And I've heard from actually the guest, one of our very early guests on the show, he was doing maybe right outside of Los Angeles or right outside of San Diego. And this was going back 2 years. And that was like a extremely hot market at the time. One of the first, you know, to get hot that way. And he would do like $100,000 worth in mail. So you figure that the pieces are about 50 cents. He's doing 150,000 to 200,000 letters. And he would get three deals out of there. It was just like an outrageous amount of mail that he was sending out. And it's like, you know, how long does that become sustainable? Because the way that your business, and you got one deal from 2,500 postcards, that's good. But how sustainable is that? I mean, man, one in three of the leads has to hit. Like you could do another mail campaign. And theoretically, like, what if it's a 1 in 10 hit rate and you're only getting 3 leads per campaign? Like the hit rate could go down and it could become unsustainable quick in a really hot market like that.
Yeah, certainly discouraging. Back to your comment about the real estate market not showing any signs of slowing. The good deals I bought earlier this year were from a guy who in 2006 had bought probably 30 or 35 properties. But in researching another one that I'm trying to buy from him that's currently in foreclosure, on the same day in 2006, he signed 3 mortgages that he was owner occupying all 3 of those properties. And he lived out of state and never had any intention of doing that. So that happened back then. I don't see that kind of lending right now.
Not a chance. Yeah, I've gone through that nightmare of underwriting as we speak. So let me get back on course here. We will go and to the next question. That is, who is the most successful real estate investor or developer? And why do you believe they're successful?
You know, I really like reading the Trump books. There's a lot of just furor in the press about everything. But looking at him as a real estate investor, I've learned a lot. He co-wrote a book with David Lindahl, which was something Trump University, something about real estate investing that was an incredibly well-written book. And one of the things I really get out of reading, actually, I have it somewhere in my stack here, a book written by George Ross, who's his attorney, is how phenomenally good of a negotiator Donald Trump has been in his acquisitions. And I think if you look at any part in real estate or in life where you can make the most money per minute, it's having that conversation where you're like, well, you want $300,000, but I can only give you $290,000. And in a minute, you can negotiate away $10,000. That's an incredible return.
Absolutely. Absolutely. On the heels of that, would you have 2 or 3 book recommendations that you've made most often?
Yes, and I'd rather make life book recommendations. I think there's a bunch of phenomenally great books about real estate, many of which are relatively similar. Although on that note, I'll give you one. It's part of the Rich Dad, Poor Dad series, and it's by Dolph DeRoos about real estate. That one I found was really well done. But if I had to give you a book that just changed my life and where I had that massive trajectory in 2007, starting to buy 25 properties out of owning 3, it's The Secret by Rhonda Byrne. And it's funny about The Secret. I actually got the audiobook first and I listened to it in my car probably 100 times to where I nearly had it memorized. And then I watched the movie. And it's so funny how, at least for me, I'm a visual person and I'm embarrassed to say it, but I'm judgmental. And I was looking at these people and I'm like, these are freaks. I would never take advice from people that look like that. But by then I'd already assimilated the value of their words and their thinking and acted on it. So I didn't let myself get totally scared away. But I think it's about the power of audio to like not let things detract you from the underlying message.
That is classic. That's the first time I've heard that. And now that you mention it, I'm looking back in my mind and I remember the interesting cast of characters on The Secret.
Yeah, some of them like intentionally look like I would never buy from that guy.
Yeah, that's wild. That is wild. So Fleming, if you could go back and share with your younger self, maybe 18, maybe 21, if you could share with your younger self the crown jewel of wisdom, what would that be?
Thank you. I think that's a great one. You know, my dad's a professor, and I was groomed from a kid. Like, I had to go to college, and I got 3 master's degrees. And when I look at my life right now, education is a waste. It's a waste of money. Education today, higher education, college and beyond, is really so irrelevant to succeeding in the world today. And I think people who have the highest degrees, like PhDs, they wouldn't survive a camping trip. They wouldn't survive a recession. They're not equipped for true life success. And so the advice I give to, I have a 12-year-old son, or anybody, is go to more seminars, go to where they teach practical real life investing, and then actually do it. Because sometimes I go to seminars and I see the same people and they're like, oh, have you studied Kiyosaki and have you studied this guru and that guru? And it's not about studying 10 of them. It's about taking one person's advice really serious and then applying it. And that's, I think, the main message. Take some risks, buy something now, and then find a really good mentor. Find somebody who's successful in your community and take them to lunch once a month.
Great advice. Cool. So if anybody listening wants to get some more information about you, do you have any contact information or where people can find you, Fleming?
Sure. I have a website, which is rentalrealestatebook.com. And then that has contact me information. So if anybody wants to get hold of me, ask me questions, rentalrealestatebook.com.
Great. We will make sure to put that in the show notes. I'm also going to link to Austin Stack's episode. We're going to link to Paul Sloat, the monthly market update episode, which will be for August 2017, if anybody's listening to this at a later date in the future. And I'm also going to link to Mitch Ripkin. I didn't mention this earlier, I meant to, but he was a self-managing guy like yourself, and his experience was very similar to what you had mentioned there. So I'm going to link to his episode as well, because I think it's relevant for what we had kind of talked about on this episode. So Fleming, listen, I really appreciate you taking some time out and spending it here with the REI Diamond Show listeners and myself. So I appreciate you, and I appreciate you coming on the show.
Dan, I really appreciate it. It's a great invitation, and I've listened to some of your podcasts, and it's really wonderful to see the high quality information you put out there. Very inspiring. I just want all the listeners, just do the stuff, apply it. There's no path to financial freedom like real estate. And there's that Chinese proverb, the best time to plant a tree was 30 years ago, but the second best time is now. So go buy something.
And thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamond Show. Are you interested in receiving a notification when I release the next episode? You can either sign up for email at www.reidiamonds.com or subscribe through one of the podcasting apps, including iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. We also have a link for expert guests to apply to come on the show. If you are interested in selling a deal to me, please visit www.reidiamonds.com and click the link at the top of the page. I am currently looking for deals in the Philadelphia tri-state area, the Baltimore, D.C., Maryland market, the Chicagoland region, the Atlanta region, and the Tampa Bay area in Florida. Finally, do you know anybody else who might also enjoy this episode? I'd appreciate the referrals, and I'm sure they would enjoy the episode. And last but not least, I appreciate you, my loyal REI Diamond Show listener. Dan Breslin here. Catch you later.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.